make more than investors who don't, because negative screeners are subject to constraints that others are not. In Asnas's words, constraints can never help you ex ante, and only sometimes ex post through luck. Why? Because if they help, they aren't constraints. They are what you want to do anyway. In effect, when evaluated purely on return and risk, constrained investors should only expect to make less than or equal to the return of unconstrained investors. What happens if a bunch of ESG investors don't want to own sin stocks? Well, someone else must own them, even if they end up owning more than they'd otherwise want to. How does the market solve for this? Well, it gives buyers of sin stocks a lower price for the stock and therefore a higher expected return as the underlying company goes on to earn profits for shareholders in the future. How can this be? Let's assume that, all else equal, nothing has fundamentally changed when an ESG investor chooses not to invest in or divest an existing position in a sin stock. So why is there then a lower price? If fundamentals haven't changed, then the firm's expected future cash flows remain the same. The lower price is the product of a higher discount rate. The higher discount rate is the result of less capital available to the company, or in other words, less demand for the company's stock. The discount rate is a higher cost of capital to the company because it raises money at a lower price when it offers shares. But that means a higher expected return to the sinner who buys them. Paying less for shares that earn the same amount equals a higher expected return. That doesn't necessarily mean ESG investing is pointless. It's just that by design, it is supposed to be relatively less profitable. As Asnas points out, this is precisely what ESG investors should want. By increasing sinful companies' cost of capital, they make each project they consider undertaking more expensive, so strictly fewer potential projects will be profitable. That means that by raising a sinful company's cost of capital, the ESG investor has won by making the company take on fewer of its sinful projects. But by the same token, when they force the company to sell its shares more cheaply, they also guarantee higher expected returns to the people still willing to buy them. And by constraining their own investment choices, the ESG investor lowers their own expected returns. It sucks that the virtuous have to accept a lower expected return to do good, and perhaps sucks even more that they have to accept the sinful getting a higher one, says Asnas. But he also says to embrace the suck, as without it, there is no effect on the world, no good deed done at all. Perhaps this necessary sacrifice is why it's called virtue. In response, advocates of ESG investing and stakeholder capitalism might retort that the problem with classical capitalism is that it requires businesses to focus on short-term profits rather than long-term value, and that in the long run, analyses will prove that ESG-informed investment approaches are indeed more successful. Klaus Schwab, in his recent book Stakeholder Capitalism, echoes this refrain. Under a paradigm of stakeholder capitalism, companies do not have to stop pursuing profits for their shareholders, he says. All it takes is they shift to a long-term perspective. The question of why this simple truism deserves entire books, let alone a new global movement to reinvent capitalism, is a mystery. Even Milton Friedman believed that the pursuit of profits over the long run dominates short-term profit-seeking when you compare the two strategies over, well, the long run. It's pretty intuitive. Suppose a company's stock price craters because it misses the quarterly earnings benchmark that analysts had set, but the company is actually destined to generate a lot more cash flow in the future. What happens? Some investors may foolishly sell their shares. That's what causes the stock price to crater. But that creates an opportunity for somebody else to buy those shares at an even lower price and to make even more money over the long run. This happens every day. It's what made Warren Buffett a multi-billionaire. Many other billionaires have made their fortunes following his formula. Individual investors mint small fortunes each year using similar strategies. There's even a name for this strategy. It's called value investing. Indeed, Big Pharma's short-termism is what allowed me to start Roivant in 2014. It was always a head-scratcher for me that large pharma companies often had billions of dollars in their bank accounts, yet felt such acute pressure to meet the quarterly earnings benchmarks set for them by some 30-year-old analyst at a Wall Street bank. CEOs of these pharma behemoths often feel compelled to make cuts to their R&D budgets to improve their profitability on paper in a given calendar year, even though the underlying research projects that involve making investments today may actually be far more profitable in the long run. This is the kind of woe that folks like Klaus Schwab lament in their hackneyed critiques of short-termism. Yet they miss the fact that even though those particular corporations who act according to short-term impulses may miss out on long-term profits, society overall doesn't miss out because someone else just takes advantage of the business opportunity. As the rapper Macklemore eloquently says it, one man's trash is another man's come-up. In the case of my company, I initially got the business off the ground by in-licensing drugs from pharma companies that were far more financially well-heeled than my own, but that nonetheless succumbed to short-term pressure to cut R&D projects. In some cases, they had invested tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars into a promising drug that they had to cut simply because they would have lost an extra few million dollars in their budget, even though they had billions of dollars in their bank accounts and are worth hundreds of millions of dollars in their own right. Why? Because Wall Street tends to focus on the profit line at the bottom of an income statement in a given year, turning a blind eye to how a company can deploy its balance sheet into investment that generates even more profits in the future, even if that comes at the expense of profitability in the near term. Of course, that doesn't make any sense. It's one of many reasons why the efficient market hypothesis is a load of garbage. But the good news is that it's what allowed people like Warren Buffett to get rich and people like me to build successful companies. I was able to pay a small upfront payment, often just a few million dollars, for drugs that could be worth tens or hundreds of times more. Why? Because my company was a private startup, we didn't have to obsess over quarterly earnings calls. It didn't matter if our annual income statement showed a loss in the early years, and my investors understood that. So we were able to buy drugs that larger companies had invented and had often invested fortunes in, paying literally pennies on the dollar relative to their true value. Drugs are risky, and some of them failed. But enough of them would go on to succeed to make the entire project a value-creating one, and on a scale measured in the billions. Best of all, society benefits too. Several of those drugs are now approved by the FDA for patients with important diseases, ranging from prostate cancer to overactive bladder. I can proudly say that those drugs would have never reached patients if they had stayed in the hands of the companies that were oriented towards the short term, or apparently those whose CEOs didn't think that urology was a sufficiently sexy area for investment. Patients in the real world benefit today because my company was able to take advantage of a market inefficiency created by other pharma companies that care about pursuing short-run profits. At the same time, I was able to generate a lot of wealth for Roivant's shareholders, including myself, in the process. All stakeholders, including shareholders, benefit. That's how capitalism works in reality. Yes, it's true that some investors and companies think of the short run, and they often succeed by doing that with the mentality of a trader rather than a long-term owner. But when they sacrifice the pursuit of long-run value, that often creates an even juicier, more profitable opportunity for someone else. Here's the punchline. That's not stakeholder capitalism. That's just capitalism. Brazen cost-cutting for one company creates a golden opportunity for another. Investors who follow the crowd and dump a stock because of a bad quarterly report create fertile inefficiencies for other investors to exploit. The logical approach to address the perils of short-termism isn't to reinvent the rules of global capitalism. It's to start a business or to invest capital in ways that capture those opportunities. All told, this critique of short-termism ends up being a straw man that doesn't actually defeat the theoretical argument for why ESG investors should systematically underperform other investors. That wraps up the theoretical debate. So how does this theory actually perform in practice? If you ask most ESG proponents, they'd say that the empirical data decisively prove that the foregoing theory is bogus. Indeed, the most popular argument for ESG investing is that it works. In 2020, Al Gore boldly took this argument one step further. In a widely read Wall Street Journal editorial, he argued that voluminous research has conclusively shown that businesses properly integrating ESG factors into their plans are typically more successful and more profitable. As the value of this paradigm becomes widely recognized, investors who fail to take it into account may be at risk of violating their fiduciary duty to their clients. According to Gore, it's no longer simply optional for corporate executives to practice ESG principles. They have an affirmative legal obligation to embrace them. As an aside, take a look at the fine print in Gore's slippery reasoning. For example, note that he adds the qualifier properly to his declaration, which leaves a lot of wiggle room. That is, if certain ESG stocks happen to underperform, Gore can simply say those businesses didn't implement ESG values properly, just as someone in the opposite camp could say that underperforming pure profit businesses didn't focus on pure profits properly. A classic case of the logical trap known as the No True Scotsman fallacy. Here's how the No True Scotsman fallacy works. Suppose I say that no Scotsman wears red socks. You counter by pointing out that your friend Logan wears red socks. I then say, ah, but no true Scotsman wears red socks. On this count, Larry Fink is more polished than Gore. In a paper titled A Fundamental Reshaping of Finance, Fink writes, BlackRock's investment conviction is that sustainability and climate-integrated portfolios can provide better risk-adjusted returns to investors. Fink's comments were well-crafted to elude criticism. He didn't say that ESG portfolios will provide better returns, but only that they can. That's harder to argue with, even though average mom-and-pop investors probably don't stop to make the distinction. And Fink has ample quantitative support to back up his claims. In 2019, Savitha Subramanian, head of U.S. Equity and Quantitative Strategy and Global ESG Research at Bank of America, observed that U.S. companies with high ESG rankings in the S&P 500 index outperformed their counterparts with lower ESG rankings by at least 3% each year for the preceding 5 years. Subramanian went so far as to argue that ESG metrics are the best measure for signaling future earnings risk, superior even to financial risk factors like the level of a company's leverage or debt burden. Harvard Business School professor George Serafim, working in collaboration with Boston Mutual Fund manager State Street, observed that during the market collapse in the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, firms experiencing more positive sentiment on their human capital, supply chain, and operational response to COVID-19 experienced higher institutional money flows and less downside in share prices. Similar analyses abound. Morningstar found that sustainable index funds outperformed traditional index funds in the first quarter of 2020. Hermes Investment Management observed in 2018 that companies with good or improving ESG characteristics outperform companies with poor or worsening characteristics. Countless other reports come to similar conclusions. So which one is right? The theoretical account or the empirical account? The answer is neither. As for the empirical data, on closer inspection, it's mixed at best. Most of the analyses are contrived, cherry-picked, or circular. Take the analysis from Serafim and State Street, for example. Their argument is both circular and conflating. They say that firms experiencing more positive sentiment were the ones that experienced higher institutional money flows and thus performed better in the stock market. Yet that argument fails to distinguish whether ESG asset class outperformance, even if it exists, is actually a function of improved underlying corporate performance or simply a function of an asset bubble driven by growing pools of capital chasing socially conscious investment opportunities. Serafim's dataset suggests it's the latter, that positive share price performance correlates with favorable news coverage. In other words, he's saying that the best reason for investing in ESG-oriented companies is that everyone else is doing it. Further, it's even debatable whether ESG-oriented companies actually do command higher stock prices or not. It depends on how you count. For example, in contrast to Bank of America, Credit Suisse observed that the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, which represents the top 10% of the world's most sustainable companies by market capitalization per industry in the S&P Global BMI, has underperformed the full S&P Global Benchmark Index by approximately 20% from 2010 to 2019. Institutional Investor observed that median annualized returns between 2010 and 2019 of ESG equity funds with a track record of at least 10 years and $100 million in assets was only 11.98%, while the S&P 500 had returned an annualized 13.56%. Volatility was identical across both indices, suggesting that ESG assets underperformed not only on an absolute basis, but on a risk-adjusted basis as well. Many of the analyses in favor of ESG outperformance are cherry-picked. Fudge factors include which companies to include versus exclude, the relevant time horizon to examine, what benchmark indices to use, and so on. Those are fundamentally subjective decisions, often made by the very people who know what conclusion they wish to reach. In sum, the existence of dueling datasets shouldn't surprise anyone. In this case, the data itself is a charade. Data doesn't mix well with self-interest or politics, and here it's blended with both. The so-called empirical exercises are in actuality agenda-driven all the way down. It's no accident that Savitha Subramanian, the analyst at Bank of America who concluded that ESG stocks outperform, also headed up their global ESG research group. If she reached the opposite conclusion, she might be out of a job. The same might go for Larry Fink. A cynic may rightly conclude that he just needed to find a new excuse for raising capital to actively manage under his mutual fund complex, and to justify higher fees than passive index funds like Vanguard charge their clients. Passive index funds were starting to take market share from the higher fee mutual fund business, so the rise of ESG investing may well have saved the day for the likes of Fink. At the end of the day, it's debatable whether ESG investment strategies have outperformed or underperformed conventional investment strategies. They're certainly not the slam dunk that Larry Fink or Al Gore would have you believe. On the other hand, there's no clear data set that clearly proves the theoretical argument that ESG should consistently underperform either. There are still many analyses that argue that ESG stocks have outperformed. So what gives? One very real possibility is that we are in an ESG asset bubble that is ripe to crash, just like the housing bubble in 2008. A true hallmark of many financial bubbles is the overflow of funds into a particular asset class. It's hard to argue that we're not seeing that in the ESG sector today. Morningstar estimates about $50 billion of capital flows into U.S. sustainable open-end and exchange-traded funds in 2020, approximately 10 times more than in 2018, and 2.5 times more than in 2019. According to the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investments 2020 report, total U.S. domiciled assets under management employing ESG investing strategies increased 42% between 2018 and 2020, up to $17 trillion. This means that ESG mandated assets now represent a staggering 33% of the $51.4 trillion of U.S. assets under professional management. This composition is only expected to rise. ESG mandated assets are projected to represent 50% of all managed assets in the U.S. by 2025. The point? There is a lot of money piling into ESG and sustainable investing right now. It's reminiscent of the amount of money that piled into home loans as a result of mandates in the years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis. Good fundraising strategies don't always make for good investment strategies. Asset prices may rise in the short run because there are more dollars chasing them due to the expectation they'll keep rising. But that's the logic of a Ponzi scheme. It's what Burton Malkiel refers to as the greater fool theory in his book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. As long as there's another buyer, the gravy train keeps running, yet it only lasts for so long. Who wins this game? Just like in 2008, the answer is large financial institutions. Mutual fund complexes like BlackRock make money based on the totality of assets that they manage, not based on the actual investment performance of those assets. If you've ever invested in a mutual fund, you've probably noticed that they quote a fee for their product, often something like 1%. Know that they're referring to the fee that they charge on the money you hand over to them, not on the actual gains that they generate. In fact, mutual funds like BlackRock profit just the same, whether they make money or they lose money. Just like during the pre-2008 housing bubble, the people who sold financial products stood to gain whether the underlying investment strategy performed well or not. So is it time to short the growing ESG asset bubble and make a ton of money when the whole thing collapses, just like the smartest hedge funds did in 2007 when the housing bubble collapsed? If market logic were all that mattered, I'd bet my money on it. But there's another relevant actor in the game. Government. Here's the issue. Woke capitalists often win in the end because they use their do-good smokescreen to capture the government itself. Unfortunately, that often proves to be the most profitable strategy of all. It's modern crony capitalism, and it works. The winning trade may not be to short ESG stocks, but to short American democracy. After BlackRock created its Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, the firm quietly secured its status as the main financial administrator of the economic stimulus package during the COVID-19 pandemic, effectively playing the role of the government, and probably made a pretty penny for doing it. In January 2020, pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca announced to much fanfare at, of course, the World Economic Forum in Davos, a new investment commitment of $1 billion over 10 years into environmental sustainability initiatives to fight climate change. Just a couple of months later, it received a $1.2 billion grant, not a loan, but a grant from U.S. taxpayers to subsidize the development of for-profit vaccines. Flushing $1 billion down the drain over 10 years may be financially nonsensical, but it's a pretty good trade in return for getting $1.2 billion now. The list of examples goes on. My point isn't that there was some explicit quid pro quo in these particular exchanges. Almost certainly there wasn't. Rather, it's that this new corporate practice of feigning wokeness indirectly wins favors in return from the government over the long run. Favorable legislative treatment, lenient prosecutorial discretion, fiscal grants, and other forms of corporate welfare. During Republican administrations, big companies used to gain political advantage by lending their alumni to occupy powerful government positions. Even President Trump, a swamp drainer, filled the posts of Secretary of Treasury and Secretary of State with recent Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil executives. Now, corporations have simply come up with a new trick tailored for Democrats. They lend corporate power as a tool to implement radical agendas that Democrats could never pass in Congress. That's exactly what we are seeing in the early days of President Biden's tenure. He called climate change the number one issue facing humanity and outlined a plan to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 and other environmental initiatives, all building on the Green New Deal, a flawed but ambitious resolution advanced by congressional Democrats in 2019. The original Green New Deal failed in a Republican-controlled Senate, and it's unlikely to do any better in a 50-50 split Senate that includes Joe Manchin. But with the advent of the modern alliance between big government and big business, new laws may not be required at all. The Biden administration can simply use Wall Street's ESG apparatus to do it instead. Earlier this year, Politico reported that U.S. climate envoy and former Secretary of State John Kerry wants America's banks on board with the administration's climate goals, and that he was leveraging his personal ties with Wall Street to persuade Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and J.P. Morgan Chase to create a U.S. net zero banking alliance. The effort was reportedly aimed at drawing pledges that could be announced for the administration's climate strategy rollout. Do we really want to live in a democracy where top government officials leverage their personal ties with the CEOs of big banks to accomplish what they can't get done in Congress? Banks are not charitable institutions. When they do favors for government officials, they expect something in return. The real question is this: what did America's banks get in return for agreeing to Kerry's climate-related demands? I doubt we'll ever know, but the answer goes to the heart of why the likes of Larry Fink and Al Gore may have the last laugh in the end. Reducing carbon emissions, implementing racial diversity goals, and waxing eloquent about social justice don't inherently make them more profitable. That's just the dowry they pay in return for the protection of big government, consummating the marriage of America's newest power couple. To be clear, it's not that I think furthering social causes is meritless. Some are definitely worthwhile. I'm just skeptical that an investment strategy centered on these narrow characteristics is likely to outperform in the long run, or to substantively advance the cause in a way that's actually impactful. Even if some good comes out of it, that's outweighed by the negative consequences of the outsized political and social influence that these ESG-oriented investors and executives exercise. There are better ways to further those same social causes. One way is through targeted and meaningful nonprofit endeavors. Another is through sound government policy with proper democratic accountability, including open public debate and the ability to be elected out of office if you do a poor job. As imperfect as these solutions may be, one thing is clear to me: mixing ancillary social causes with the pursuit of profit is a bad investment in every sense. Here's another good way to advance a social cause: make a great product that happens to help the cause you care about. Don't just throw money at ESG funds. Make an exceptional product that advances your goals, and sell a lot of it. That's the kind of business that shareholder capitalists and stakeholder capitalists can both get behind. Making a great product that happens to serve your social goals is an authentic form of stakeholder capitalism, like the kind that focuses on minimizing harm. I discussed the harm-minimizing kind of stakeholder capitalism at the end of Chapter 1. Take a couple of causes that are near and dear to my heart. I'm a vegetarian, for religious reasons and moral ones. I think it's generally wrong to kill animals simply for culinary pleasure. I also consider myself to be an environmentalist. I care a lot about the quality of the air that people breathe and the water people drink. The right way to advance these goals through a commercial enterprise isn't for a biotech CEO to use the company as a platform to advocate against pollution and killing animals. Rather, it's to start a company that creates products that accomplish those same goals. And indeed, several companies today are doing just that. Take Upside Foods, formerly Memphis Meats, led by Uma Valetti, which grows meats from the ground up using the building blocks of life: cells. Rather than slaughtering animals, Upside sources these cells from animals and cultivates the cells by feeding them essential nutrients. According to Upside, meat can be made healthier, safer, and more nutritious through its process. I first met Uma at an event hosted by a large institutional investor, where one of the events involved test-driving race cars. Yes, these are the kinds of things that CEOs do at fancy conferences in places like Los Angeles. Uma and I drove a race car together, and we had a chance to chat during the ride while we weren't turning around hairpin bends. At first, when he started telling me about the mission orientation of his company, I reflexively rolled my eyes. Blah, blah, I thought. But over the course of the conversation, two things became clear to me. First, he was a better race car driver than I was. And second, he was genuine and sincere about his actual desire to improve the world through his company's work. In his personal life, he converted to veganism, and it wasn't just for show. He believed in animal rights, and that was the very reason he'd started Upside Foods. By the end, I believed him, and I hope he succeeds. Similarly, Beyond Meat is a public company that specializes in plant-based protein products. Instead of using animal cells, Beyond Meat sources proteins, fats, minerals, flavors, and colors, and carbohydrates from plant-based sources like peas, beans, potatoes, and brown rice, to produce its meat alternatives. Beyond Meat believes that by shifting from animal and plant-based meat, they can positively impact four growing global issues: human health, climate change, constraints on natural resources, and animal welfare. According to a comparative assessment, its Beyond Burger generates 90% less greenhouse gas emissions, requires 46% less energy, has over 99% less impact on water scarcity, and 93% less impact on land use than a quarter pound of U.S. beef. Personally, I'm not sure Beyond Meat and other brands like Impossible Foods will meet all their lofty goals. In fact, Beyond Meat and competitors have been criticized for making overly processed products that are not as healthy as they claim to be. Their stated connection to climate change in particular seems a bit tenuous to me, but the connection to animal welfare and environmental respect is straightforward. I applaud these companies for trying. They're inventing innovative, potentially world-changing technologies to advance causes that their founders personally care about. That's fundamentally different from a new-age tech company making glossy brochures about board diversity in a bid to make it into BlackRock's ESG portfolio. Institutional investors should stop playing this game of shuffling money around and rewarding companies that they like and punishing ones they dislike based on factors that have nothing to do with commercial value. CEOs should stop playing the same game on the other side by making hollow proclamations that have nothing to do with their companies. If you want to improve the world through your business, there's a better way. Make a great product that you believe in. Chapter 6: An Arranged Marriage. When people hear my mom came here from India, one of the first questions they ask her is, "Did you have an arranged marriage?" Today, I ask that question of corporations when they espouse woke causes. I want to tell you about two arranged marriages in this chapter, one that worked and one that didn't. Let's start with the success story. My mom skips the extended story these days, but I like it, so I'm going to tell it. Don't worry, it'll be about wokeness and capitalism in the end. That'll be the second arranged marriage, the failed one. My mom, Geetha, and her sister were the apples of their parents' eyes. Her father was a traveling salesman, and her mother was a homemaker. My grandparents spent every moment of their lives striving to give their daughters the things they'd never had, including a proper education. Both children became doctors. Thanks to a good test score, my mom got to skip undergrad and go straight to medical school at 16, both a blessing and a curse. She arrived there a shy, sheltered teenager, who'd barely even spoken to any men outside her family. The first day, surrounded by a class full of older men, she stared at the ground the whole time and hoped that no one would talk to her. Grandpa walked her to and from school every day to protect her from catcalls. Years later, my mom graduated with excellent grades, only to realize that her parents were off to their next mission: finding her a husband. She had never held hands with a man. She imagined herself as the star of a Bollywood movie, meeting the hero of her dreams and running around trees singing songs while dressed in a beautiful sari. Parents end up being good matchmakers. They literally go down a checklist of compatibility: family background, cultural and religious values, dietary preferences, education, looks, and of course, astrological compatibility. Maybe Grandpa really was just a genius at reading horoscopes. He came home from one of his long trips one day, brandishing a horoscope and a couple pictures of a potential groom, a PhD student in America, whose face struck her as handsome but so serious. My dad, VG, passed all her parents' tests with flying colors. My mom dreamt of singing birds and beautiful saris. My mom and her parents took a long trip to Vatikanjeri to meet VG's family, though VG had already immigrated to America. My mom was swarmed by first, second, and third cousins. Everyone liked her, but VG's mothers and aunts raised a serious question. Was she tall enough? They had her stand next to a niece for comparison and held a friendly yet spirited debate. My mom and her parents went home a few hours later after a great visit, but that crucial question remained unanswered. My mom came back to Vatikanjeri a month later, and this time, VG was there. There were somehow even more cousins than before. VG walked into the room with a charming smile, and my mom decided that he wasn't overly serious after all. After dinner, VG and my mom were led into a private room and seated in two chairs facing each other. It was crunch time. This was their chance to have a private moment and really get to know each other. All the adults followed them into the private room, and the children perched on the windowsills outside to observe. VG really wanted to make sure she was okay going to America, a strange and foreign land. She was. Things were going smoothly, perhaps too smoothly for one of VG's aunts, who interjected to make sure he knew my mom was only 5'3", while he stood at 5'11". VG hastily corrected her to point out that he was actually 5'10". My mom laughed, along with everyone else. Maybe their meeting had been arranged, but that was really the moment he proposed, and she accepted. They got married 12 days later. On her wedding day, my mom held a man's hand for the first time, and that made it mean all the more to her. That was 38 years ago. They're still together. My mom and dad often say that trust is the foundation of their marriage. They trusted the judgments of their parents to find each other, and that in turn gave them trust in each other. They weren't thinking about what each of them would get out of it. There was no quid pro quo. That's the first arranged marriage I want to tell you about, and it turned out to be a good one. But now, let's talk about a marriage of convenience, one that left both partners worse off than they started. I refer to the unholy union of wokeness and capitalism, more of an arranged marriage than my parents ever was. Circumstances forced wokeness and capitalism together, and they only stayed together so they could both gain money and power, but each secretly disdained the other. The seeds of this unhappy marriage were sown decades ago, but wokeness hadn't even been born yet. Capitalism was coming of age. The story begins not with a courtship, but a rivalry. Our contemporary understanding of capitalism is influenced by a little appreciated intellectual feud between Milton Friedman and Klaus Schwab. In 1970, Friedman famously wrote in the New York Times Magazine that the social purpose of the corporation was to pursue profit. He argued that the doctrine of social responsibility in business, if taken seriously, would extend the scope of the political mechanism to every human activity. He warned that its proponents were preaching pure and unadulterated socialism and undermining the basis of a free society. Yet as Friedman argued for shareholder primacy, other prominent economists organized against him. In 1973, Schwab, the World Economic Forum executive chairman, wrote the Davos Manifesto, calling for a new code of ethics for business leaders. Executives were no longer to simply seek a return on investment for their shareholders, Schwab declared, but to serve their workers and employees, as well as societies, and to harmonize the different interests of the stakeholders. Corporate executives and investors were beginning to redefine the very purpose of the corporation. The single largest driver of prosperity in American history, the corporation, was to be legally and structurally reimagined and rebuilt with an eye toward social responsibility. The motivation of a corporation and its leaders would change to reconcile the disparate interests of stakeholders, as Schwab said in 1973. It was to be left to a class of capitalist leaders to decide just what that meant. So every January they met at a ski resort in Davos, Switzerland, to pontificate about ethical capitalism. Speaking of pontificating about ethical capitalism, Schwab just came out with a book on stakeholder capitalism, cunningly titled Stakeholder Capitalism. I was asked to review it for the Wall Street Journal. The first two-thirds of the book is Schwab's history of the world economic system since World War II. The short of it is, things were good for a while, and then climate change and inequality became problems. In the last third, Schwab gets to the solution, which he presents in an updated Davos Manifesto. It's typical of Davos think that his new manifesto asserts that a good company serves society at large as a steward of the environmental and material universe for future generations. Steward means unofficial king in my book. Schwab's idyllic vision of benevolent company kings shepherding society toward prosperity strikes me as a very European way of thinking. Part of what it means to be American is to have no king. Notwithstanding Davos, in America, there was a broad bipartisan consensus favoring classical shareholder capitalism in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. The public debates about capitalism focused on whether government should interfere more or less in business. That's regulation. Whether or not to redistribute wealth. That's taxation. And whether businesses wielded too much pricing power over consumers. That's antitrust. Yet these narrow debates ignored the separate question of whether businesses exercised undue social, cultural, and political power. Regulations were designed to affect only market-oriented activities, or to transfer wealth from those who had it to those who didn't. But regulations were mostly unconcerned about the question of corporate power beyond the market. That was a crucial lingering question, like my mom's height. No one in America really debated finding a suitable partner for capitalism. Part of the whole point of shareholder capitalism was that it was meant to exist on its own, with its own goals. American capitalism was independent. It didn't need a spouse. But the 2008 financial crisis marked a critical turning point in public attitudes toward classical capitalism. The big banks controlled so much power in the financial market that they were deemed by the U.S. government too big to fail, requiring a taxpayer-funded bailout of Wall Street itself. U.S. Secretary Hank Paulson, who was CEO of Goldman Sachs before assuming his cabinet post, picked favorites. Shamefully, he chose to bail out Goldman Sachs, his alma mater, while letting certain of his less favorite rivals, like Lehman Brothers, go bankrupt without any assistance. To this day, neither Paulson nor other decision makers have offered a satisfactory account for how they made the decision to bail out some large investment banks, but not others. It was crony capitalism at its worst. For Paulson, the combination of his tenure at Goldman Sachs and his time as U.S. Treasury Secretary left him a particularly wealthy man. Paulson had amassed a fortune in the form of a $700 million equity stake in Goldman Sachs, and ordinarily, he would pay capital gains taxes when liquidating that equity. Yet because of a tax loophole reserved only for government-appointed officials, Paulson was able to take advantage of a provision that allowed him to sell his assets while deferring capital gains so long as the proceeds of his sales were reinvested in government-approved securities within 60 days. The purpose of this loophole was supposedly to avoid a conflict of interest. In reality, the ignominious choice Paulson made as U.S. Treasury Secretary to advantage Goldman Sachs over others showed that the tax loophole didn't deter corruption, it invited it. The public was understandably livid about having to support bankers who made more money than they did in good times, yet who required a bailout from the public when things went bad. Public attitudes toward capitalism became jaded. Capitalism was equated with cronyism, and rightly so. The public came to expect something different from business leaders and government leaders alike. That's when modern stakeholder capitalism really took off, the moment where the Klaus Schwab crowd overtook Milton Friedman in the fast lane. Meanwhile, in 2008, a former community organizer was elected president of the United States. For the first time in decades, a true political reordering of the power structure appeared possible, if not likely. Wall Street was overrun by the Occupy Wall Street movement. My hedge fund bosses in 2008 advised the new class's analysts that compensation would be chronically lower for years to come, and one of them warned me that if we wanted to exit the finance world, now is probably a good time. And then something curious happened. Consider what happened at an Occupy Wall Street protest in Richmond, Virginia, in October of 2011. A group of protesters had gathered in Monroe Park at the first General Assembly of Occupy Wall Street, a movement that had grown in fewer than 3 years to be something more than just a local affair in Lower Manhattan. One particular incident happened to be captured on video by an attendee. A white woman in her late 20s spoke to a sprawling audience in the park. She explained at the start of the rally how things were going to work. The leaders of the protest were going to start emulating a practice that had originated in New York City, stacking names, a list of people who were due to speak at the rally. But it came with a twist. The stack was to be administered as a progressive stack. This means that if you're on the list and you come from a traditionally marginalized background, then you move up higher on the list. But this was an Occupy Wall Street movement. Everyone there was protesting on behalf of those who were marginalized and against those who wielded disproportionate economic power, right? The millennial white woman had an answer for that too. Race, gender, or ethnicity, anything that is sufficiently marginalized, you get bumped up the list. We want to hear what everyone has to say, she explained. There were a couple of distributed shouts of woohoo from the audience, but they were scattered, and most of the attendees listened with attentive silence. She continued with her explanation to the crowd. "Also, one of the things stressed at Occupy Wall Street now is step up, step back." There was a notable verbal emphasis when she said step back. "This means that people who have been privileged their entire lives, white men, maybe women even, people who have been privileged need to step up and step back." The crowd murmured. After some uncomfortable silence, someone spoke up from the back. He didn't identify himself, but he was a white male. In response, he said, I think it doesn't matter, you know, what their general background is, because, you know, most of us are already part of the marginalized class of people." Some people in the crowd sounded boos in dissent, while others could be heard saying yeah in assent. Continuing, he said, "Your background doesn't matter because more people would get to speak anyway, and I think..." But then he was interrupted as more people began to object to what he had to say. He asked, "What?" He was confused why anyone thought he was saying anything wrong. And then a speaker interrupted him from the stage. "We are talking about privilege. You have privilege over other people at certain levels. Some of us are far more marginalized than others. There are people who are way more marginalized than we are." This speaker from the stage was, of course, also a white man. According to this new orthodoxy, the problem really wasn't corporate power, as Occupy Wall Street had presupposed. Rather, it was based on inherited disempowerment. Race and gender, the immutable and the visible, took the place of class-based struggle. Decades of critical theory at American universities gave the imprimatur of the academy and its supposed rigor to these new ideas. In short, woke culture stole the show. Unlike Occupy Wall Street, wokeness called on its practitioners to wake up to the privileges that certain people, generally straight white men, are born with, rather than inequalities arising from other factors, like, say, the exercise of corporate power. Wall Street didn't have to kill Occupy Wall Street from the outside. Instead, woke culture eroded it from within. And so began Wall Street's love affair with wokeness. My mom often says that marriages are made in heaven and simply arranged on earth by your parents, by a website, or by serendipity itself. There's something beautiful, even metaphysical, about that idea. But the marriage of big business and woke culture was made in hell. It certainly wasn't born from love. It was arranged by necessity. Wokeness needed money. Wall Street needed a moral imprimatur. So Wall Street eagerly embraced the new identity-based hierarchy and used wokeness to shield itself from the harsh glare the financial crisis had shed on it. That was the dowry of this arranged marriage. By adopting these new woke values, America's business leaders stumbled upon a once-in-a-generation opportunity to leap from heresy to sainthood. Corporations were no longer the oppressors. Instead, corporate power, if wielded in the right way, could actually empower the new disempowered classes who suffered not at the hands of evil corporations, but instead at the hands of straight white men, the real culprits who had exploited their power not only since the birth of the corporation, but throughout all of modern human history. Enter woke capitalism, or more elegantly, the multi-stakeholder model of the corporation. The corporation would no longer exist to serve just shareholders, but the interests of society at large, including those who deserved the kind of special protections that the rest of society had failed to afford. Women, people of color, LGBTQ people, victims of climate change. The tailwinds for this new conception of capitalism couldn't have been better timed to serve the objectives of the new class of corporate titans who readily espoused this new model. To be sure, the causes for the meteoric rise of wokeness in America are complex and plural in nature. Generational demographic trends surely played a role. By the early 2000s, as children of America's baby boomers entered adulthood, America was poised to witness the largest intergenerational wealth transfer in the nation's history. In the early 20th century, Ludwig von Mises summarized in his book, The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality, that the son of a self-made man has an opportunity to exceed his father's accomplishments in one of two ways. The first is to beat his father on his own terms. That's hard and risky and unlikely to succeed. The second approach was to be morally superior to one's own father, a goal that's easier to achieve because moral superiority can be subjectively defined. According to Mises, anti-capitalism thus serves an important psychological need created by capitalism itself. So what happens when an entire generation stands to benefit from the economic spoils of their parents' work? Enter millennials, the children of baby boomers. For example, many of my peers at Harvard and at Yale grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, attended the Ethical Culture Fieldston School, and then matriculated at Ivy League colleges, often advantaged by their parents' alumni status. These were the kids who needed at once to benefit from their parentally endowed privileges, while also being morally superior to their parents for recognizing those privileges. Becoming woke to genetically inherited attributes like whiteness fit the bill perfectly, since it allowed an entire generation to blame their forefathers for the sin they had inherited at birth. It wasn't quite their fault. It was someone else's sin that they were merely burdened with. When big business took up their causes, the woke movement, having already shunned their sinful parents, awkwardly embraced their new corporate patrons. So in a nutshell, here's how wokeness and capitalism shacked up. Large corporations knocked up woke millennials. Together, they birthed woke capitalism, and they put Occupy Wall Street up for adoption. That trade couldn't have come at a better time for big business. On the back of the government scratching Wall Street's back with its corrupt bailout, it was corporate America's turn to return the favor. They did it by directly assuming the responsibilities of democratic government, especially the agendas of liberal politicians who might otherwise have harmfully regulated or penalized big business. Messy debates about racial inequality? Don't worry, we've got it covered. New policies to fight climate change? We'll take care of that too. Big business volunteered to take on the role of liberal government itself, crucially, on terms that were favorable to its own interests. That's what woke capitalism is all about. It's the hip new avatar of old school crony capitalism. Wall Street and Silicon Valley pounced on the opportunity. Capitalist elites were able to skillfully craft a new conception of social purpose, not as an alternative to capitalism, but rather through capitalism itself. Al Gore, who famously invented the internet and then went on to discover climate change, had now made his greatest discovery of all, a new model for the corporation that existed to serve not just shareholders, but also other societal stakeholders as well. And he also raised a large-scale family of ESG, environmental, social, and governance-oriented funds, that turned him from an impecunious former civil servant into an investment titan worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Those who followed in his mold, riding what was to become a boom in the ESG asset class over the subsequent decade, were also handsomely rewarded. On the one hand, Gore advocated to repeal Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission because it allowed companies to influence government. On the other hand, he became a professional investor in companies that proposed to replace the work of government and to get rich himself by doing it. Not a bad consolation prize for losing a presidential election. What makes an arranged marriage work? My mom and dad's arranged marriage worked because people who knew them and cared about them got them together after thinking hard about whether they'd be compatible. Each of their parents ran through an exhaustive checklist. The whole point of it all was to make sure that each of them would end up as happy as possible. And when the time came, the decision about whether to get married or not came down to whether they liked each other. That's not how wokeness and capitalism came to be intertwined. The way I see it, corporations were the one who arranged that marriage, and they arranged it mostly to take the heat off themselves after the financial crisis. Get people talking about identity politics, and they'll stop talking about socialism and, perish the thought, communism. Robin DiAngelo, high-fee speaker and author of White Fragility, and other elite diversity consultants like her, are no threat to big banks. But Karl Marx is. You can pay a diversity consultant good money to do the rounds giving bankers seminars on how whiteness is bad. It's much harder to buy off a principled Marxist, and bankers would not like the seminars they would give. So corporations embraced wokeness to give themselves cover from the financial crisis and to direct anger toward white men instead of capitalism. Yes, big business is a problem, they'd say, but what do you expect when it's run by white men? We all know that patriarchy is the real problem, along with racism. Oh, now you want to say systemic racism is the problem? Yes, yes, very good. Systemic racism and systemic patriarchy. We condemn them. Look, we'll even build a statue for you. Just don't say that systemic financial risk is the problem. So corporations never truly loved wokeness, even as they embraced it and married it to capitalism. They always intended to use it. But wokeness never truly loved capitalism either. There was nothing fundamentally woke about capitalism, no natural compatibility. When corporations started proclaiming that wokeness and capitalism were inseparable and offering money and status to anyone who could help spread that message, each side accepted the proposal not because there was any truth to it, but because it was profitable. I don't just mean that the marriage of wokeness and capitalism was profitable to the woke in monetary terms, though it was. I'd love to see Robin DiAngelo and Ibram Kendi disclose the speaking fees they've earned from preaching about white privilege and anti-racism to corporations. It's definitely in the millions of dollars, the only question is how many. But the main thing wokeness gets out of this marriage of convenience is that it gets to use every major company as a platform to blast its message to the universe. Money was not the only dowry that corporations offered. What they really promised wokeness was a megaphone to turbocharge its message and make it mainstream. By turning wokeness into the default ideology of business, they offered to make it the default everywhere. In exchange, corporations got to wear the protective cloak of wokeness's moral superiority. It was a cynical arrangement. I gave a presentation on an early version of this book to a class at Harvard Law School. What one woman said stuck with me. I thought that pointing out the cynicism and hypocrisy behind Fearless Girl and her exchange-traded fund and her lawsuits would be enough to make people see that something was deeply wrong with what she represented. But this woman basically said, "So what? She still gave me hope. I was black and a woman and felt all the odds were against me. And seeing Fearless Girl made me feel fearless too." I can't say that woman was wrong to be inspired, but that's exactly the bargain that corporations offer you with woke capitalism. Accept the way they profit from your ideals because they'll help spread them. The bargain did good things for her. I just wish it could have done them in a better way. And while the artificial connection of wokeness and capitalism may do some good for individuals, it's death for our democracy. The wedding of wokeness to capitalism offers a tempting, individually rational choice that harms the nation as a whole by handing corporations social and political power. They don't truly have wokeness's best interests at heart, and the two systems aren't truly compatible. Wokeness and capitalism simply tolerate each other because each feels it can use the other. They will turn a blind eye to each other's faults as long as they themselves can still benefit. But a marriage in which each side secretly has contempt for the other cannot end well. Chapter 7. Henchmen of the Woke Industrial Complex. There's arguably no company that embodies the marriage of wokeness and capitalism more than Unilever. Investigative journalist Maria Hengewold notes that over the last decade, the company has positioned itself as the corporate leader in the fight to empower women. If you want to join that fight, Unilever's website tells you a good place to start. Every time you scrub with Dove, wake up with Lipton, or clean up with Persil, you're supporting fempowerment by helping girls and women unlock their amazing potential. As a savvy consumer, perhaps you suspect there's something self-serving about this. That's fine. You don't have to take it from Unilever. Just listen to UN Women, a nonprofit branch of the UN dedicated to advancing gender equality and empowering women. UN Women regularly sings Unilever's praises, and the two have partnered up on many projects over the last few years, ranging from its Unstereotype Alliance, which aims to reduce gender stereotypes in advertising, to a global partnership to improve women's safety in the tea industry. Many workers in the tea-picking supply chain are women of color, and as Unilever CEO Alan Jope puts it, The immutable laws of intersectionality mean that the better the job we do for women of color, the better chance we have of progressing gender equality everywhere. The year 2016 was a tumultuous year for Unilever's feminist efforts. On the one hand, it began its journey with UN Women to protect female workers in the entire world's tea industry. On the other, it was facing a lawsuit from a group of its Kenyan tea plantation workers who claimed it had failed to protect them from rape. I drew many of the details of this story from Hengewold's reporting. The story of Unilever's mutually profitable partnership with UN Women is inextricably connected to that lawsuit from its Kenyan workers, who continue to seek justice from Unilever to this day. In December 2007, after the local ethnic majority's preferred candidate lost Kenya's presidential election, hundreds of men attacked the ethnic minority workers on Unilever's plantation. They looted and burned thousands of homes and raped husbands and wives in front of their children. At least 56 women were raped. Many people were maimed, and at least 11 were killed. Some of their attackers were their own Unilever co-workers. Unilever had been worried about possible violence before the election, so it stationed guards around its facilities and its management's homes, but none at the workers' camps. Unilever closed the plantation for 6 months after the attack. When the brutalized workers returned, they saw many of their attackers still working there. Instead of pursuing criminal charges against the attackers or paying the injured workers' hospital bills, Unilever compensated them for their suffering by giving them a month's wage. It had placed them on unpaid leave for 6 months. Unilever may believe the immutable laws of intersectionality require it to help women of color, but when its Kenyan workers sought justice from it, it hid behind the mutable laws of men. In 2015, some 218 survivors of the attack banded together to sue Unilever's Kenyan subsidiary and the British parent company in London's High Court for failing to keep them safe. Unilever claimed that as a parent company, it had no duty of care to its Kenyan workers because it wasn't actively involved in managing the Kenyan operation. Testimony from four ex-Unilever Kenya managers suggested that was false. In 2018, a UK judge sided with Unilever and ruled that the workers lacked standing to sue it. Having lost their chance for legal remedies, the women are now, as of this writing, appealing to the UN's Working Group on Business and Human Rights, hoping it will make a declaration siding with them, to place PR pressure on Unilever. Meanwhile, shortly after their lawsuit in 2016, Unilever created a broad partnership with UN Women and started donating more than $1 million a year to it. And so the Kenyan women who are pleading with Unilever for justice face a bitter irony. The only hope they have left comes from a declaration from a branch of the UN, while a different branch of the UN issues regular pronouncements about how well Unilever treats women, particularly tea pickers. The irony is, of course, not coincidental. A corporation offers woke people money and influence, and in return they lend it the protective cloak of wokeness's moral superiority to hide its wrongdoing. It's a familiar bargain, the same one I talked about in Chapter 6. It's the same thing that happened when State Street's female employees sued it over pay inequity, and State Street made a feminist statue as part of its cover-up. What's new in Unilever's variation on the arranged marriage between wokeness and capitalism is that it's hiding behind a nonprofit instead of a statue. Statues are silent, but feminist nonprofits can speak on your behalf. UN Women is surely making the same calculation all woke people do when they accept woke capitalism's proposal. It knows that Unilever is using it to provide moral cover for the Kenyan massacre, but it calculates the money from Unilever can do enough good to make that cost tolerable. UN Women said as much in a different context, when human rights activists at AIDS Free World pleaded with it to cut ties with Unilever over its marketing of skin lightening creams, which promotes white skin as good. The activists said, "We were dismayed by a reply that seemed to say that UN Women is willing to tolerate racism in exchange for a token portion of Unilever's enormous profits. What we saw was an intolerable quid pro quo and an indefensible trade-off. They're completely right. This kind of quid pro quo between woke nonprofits and corporations is an essential part of the woke industrial complex. The bargain is indefensible, but as you'll see in this chapter, it happens all the time. Here's another angle to the quid pro quo between woke nonprofits and corporations. Remember those massive settlements that companies like Goldman pay for violating laws? Like the $5 billion in fines it paid for the Malaysian scandal that I talked about in Chapter 1? Well, here's a second part of the scam. The settlement money that's supposed to go to taxpayers ends up in the pockets of left-wing nonprofits, while sometimes cutting the fines actually paid by those companies by half or more. It's still too early to know where the Goldman money is going to go, but if history is any guide, taxpayers won't see much of it. After all, that's exactly what happened with the billions of dollars in fines that Goldman Sachs and all the other major banks had to pay after the 2008 financial crisis. In Chapter 5, I described how Clinton administration policies encouraging homeownership incentivized banks to hand out subprime loans like candy to people who couldn't afford to pay them back. The banks certainly bore a large share of blame for the inevitable collapse of the mortgage-backed securities market, and there was a lot of corruption and cronyism in the way they got bailed out. But eventually, between 2014 and 2016, they did pay a price for their wrongdoing, and it was a big one on paper. Goldman Sachs reached a $5 billion settlement with the Justice Department. Maybe that's just its number. Morgan Stanley agreed to a $3 billion fine. It got off light. Citigroup got hit with a $7 billion fine. JPMorgan Chase got hit with $13 billion. And Bank of America reached the largest civil settlement in American history at nearly $17 billion. That's a lot of billions. A good chunk of that money, $11 billion, was earmarked for consumer relief to help out homeowners who had been hurt by the Great Recession. But here's the thing. Those homeowners may not have seen a dime of that money, for all we know. What we do know is that a lot of it was handed out to nonprofits picked from a list created by the federal government, and a lot of them were liberal favorites, like La Raza and the National Urban League. Andy Koenig wrote a great expose of it in the Wall Street Journal. These left-leaning nonprofits use their funds for liberal priorities like voter registration and lobbying state, local, and federal government. And it turns out they get a lot of their funding from banks via these settlements with the DOJ. Koenig studied 80 nonprofit beneficiaries of Bank of America's 2014 settlement and found that, on average, they received more than 10% of their 2015 budgets from that settlement alone. Remember, that's just one bank settlement. They were probably raking in a lot of money from the other banks, too. Bank of America is just the only big bank that disclosed exactly where it sent its money. You might wonder how this hurts taxpayers, especially if you're a liberal and you think these nonprofits fight for worthy causes. So here's the kicker. The $11 billion meant for consumer relief, not only did a lot of it go to Democratic-favored nonprofits instead, but it ended up being much less than $11 billion. That's because the DOJ offered banks a huge discount whenever they donated that money to those nonprofits. Most of the settlements gave banks double or triple credit toward their fine for every dollar they donated to these nonprofits. For instance, a Bank of America $1.15 million donation to the National Urban League counted as $2.6 million toward meeting its settlement obligation. And every $1.5 million to La Raza counted as $3.5 million of consumer relief. This is so mind-boggling that it's worth summing up. After the financial crisis, the Obama DOJ slammed big banks with massive fines so it could trumpet that it was sending tons of relief to consumers. Then it told banks that it could pay less than half that much if they donated the money to Obama's favorite nonprofits instead. And being fond of money, the banks took the DOJ up on that offer. Now that's a great quid pro quo. The DOJ gets to look good, the banks get to keep most of their money, and the liberal nonprofits get lots of funding. There's another benefit to the bank and to the DOJ. There's an